All right, part 105. So this is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 151B. We're on page 642, and we are reviewing Secret Doctrine and Cosmic Fire. He put them both together since one is the sequel of the other. First on the signs of the zodiac, and then on the planets, and we're in the section on the planets. And we've just said the names of the planets are applied in the same order everywhere. Of course, this can have to do... I see that I took a bit of a tangent and talked about the weekdays. But the equivalent names, apparently, also apply to the planets in order from the sun. So there's going to be an equivalent of Mercury in various languages, and then the next planet will be all equivalents of Venus, and then all equivalents of the Earth, and so forth. I see I gave kind of a particular interpretation in terms of the days of the week, looking for what the real Sunday might be. But now I see he's just dealing with the order. And so perhaps there were the astronomers of ancient days that were able to observe these things, and perhaps also from the Shambolic archives the names of the planets came out and were given maybe adapted names in different civilizations, which were all fed by the same Shambolic source of wisdom. Now, this is a bit like doing cosmic fire. Maybe I'm just getting warmed up. The seven planetary regents, planetary logar, that seems to be what AAB or some editor inserted, are the seven sons of Sophia, wisdom. Now, this is interesting because they are called Dragons of Wisdom. No, that's D-R-O-G. D-G. Okay, Dragons of Wisdom. That's it. Dragons of Wisdom, and they emphasize the second aspect. The second aspect of divinity. This is their emphasis. So we have love and wisdom going together, and Sophia is wisdom. And it will go as part of the second ray. So let's just say that the dragons of wisdom have not yet developed cosmic will, as has the lion of cosmic will, our solar logos. He's called the lion of cosmic will. Interestingly enough, he's moving only to the third initiation. But I suppose as you move closer to mental focus, polarization, mental polarization, then the will energy comes in stronger. So seven sons of Sophia, seven sons of wisdom, seven dragons of wisdom. That makes sense. This is from a note, Secret Doctrine 2, 221. For Pythagoras, the forces were spiritual entities, gods, independent of planets and matter as we know them on Earth, who are rulers of the sidereal heavens. In other words, let's just say, more than matter, and the forces which we had in a materialistic sense considered to be blind are not blind at all, but are directed by these inner spiritual entities who use the planets as vehicles. So much of our work has come through Pythagoras. He was the great teacher of Master DK, who was an important figure in his academy, Clinius. He is usually called Pythagoras and Clinius. Clinius, the just Greek, connected with the Pythagoreans. That's how I understand it at the present moment. And there was definitely not just a rational side to Greek philosophy when it began to deal only with the third ray, but there was a wisdom side to all of this. And Pythagoras emphasized this especially. Plato also to a great degree. By the time we got to Aristotle, who was very devoted to Plato, it turns out, and who definitely believed in the gods, we do have a more third-ray, fifth-ray emphasis upon the pure intellect without that interior mystical, deific connection. So much of what we're studying right now is coming from the Pythagorean Academy and basically Pythagorean School, and basically DK has retranslated all that, plus his knowledge of Buddhism and of Hinduism, you know, in the many subsequent incarnations. He's delivering all of that to us now. So what a rich synthesis we have as a result. All right. The seven sons of light, you know, we're talking about the planetary logo here, called after their planets and often even identified with them, namely Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, Mars, Venus, and presumably the Sun and Moon. Note that someone knows something here, you know, presumably the Sun and Moon. Well, we've left Earth out of the picture. We've left Pluto has not been discovered. Vulcan is a hidden planet. So Saturn, Jupiter in order, Mars, Earth is left out, Venus, Mercury, and presumably the Sun and Moon, but there seems to be a knowledge of veiling here. We don't know how much DK told his student, HPB, about this intricate process by which the Sun and Moon should not really be considered planets at all, but they are the lights. The Moon, in fact, is no planet in a way. It's simply a physical externalization, a former physical externalization of our planetary, the Lord of our planetary scheme. And we don't know whether the Moon and the Earth existed simultaneously. There are a lot of theories about this, you know, as if the chains form themselves in a sequential manner, but there's a problem about that because the chakras don't form themselves in a sequential manner, although developmentally they may unfold in a somewhat of a sequential manner. I mean, chakras have a complex structure, so does the chakra spring out full-blown, or is it kind of like that shallow disk that Leadbeater describes, and does it undergo a sequential developmental process? That could have an analogy in the development of the planetary chains. But, you know, it's not really the Sun and the Moon. It's planets which the Sun and Moon veil, and they're both considered to be non-sacred planets, one on the second ray and one on the fourth ray, most likely. So a non-sacred planet on the second ray. And here for the Moon, possibly, I think Douglas Baker talked about this, a non-sacred planet on the fourth ray, I think. At least that remains to be seen and to be proven. Seven sons of light, called after their planets, because actually they are gods. These are gods, great intelligences. They are, in a way, systemic ray lords. Ray lords. In other words, they exist within the solar system. The planetary ray lords or intraplanetary ray lords are within the planet itself and are seven spirits before the throne of Shambhala, but I think have their replicas in all chains and on all globes. Just how much analogous structure there is remains to be seen. Sometimes when you look at the entire range of possible beings, we are pointed to a being here, a being there, a being here, and all the spaces on Jacob's ladder are not filled in. So there are all these entities that we can fill in one day. And maybe the law of analogy, or maybe even more accurately, the law of correspondences, will help us do that. The planets have their growth, changes, development, and gradual evolution, indeed. They are beings, just like other beings in cosmos. I see another possible nice way to do this, ICS, and we'll call that in cosmos. I don't even bother turning the program off right now because it's faster to just go ahead and do this. Just like other beings in cosmos have a life cycle. And they are evolving on their way to becoming what? Maybe. What? Recombining as a solar logos? But then what are the solar logos out of which they emanate? Well, these are problems, you know, with emanation theory. This question of retractive recombination. I just want to use those words because they kind of accurately describe retractive recombination, recombination of emanated entities of the same class. So, you know, the solar angels are emanated, but they can retractively combine in relation to the planet within the sun from which they are emanated. Now, you see the whole idea, here's the question. Like this, are the planets really within, I'll make it big, within the sun or solar logos? Or are they independent beings? Well, you know, my impression about cosmos is there just are no independent beings. Nothing comes out of nothing. Well, except in the... everything comes out of nothing, but nothing comes out of nothing. There are no isolated beings who arise independently. Oh, individuality. Independently. Okay, they all have a higher source, and all things are the one. This is the prevailing view of esotericism, hotly contested and fought to the point of death by those who under Mars have a separative, egoistic mind, and want to be what they are, exactly what they are, in isolation forever. It's the superheated Ahamkara principle. The solar plexus rushes right to it and says, I will be what I am forever in heaven and ever, just what I am. And the whole idea of spiritual evolution, it must be pretty static in heaven, you know. many jokes have been made about getting tired of playing the harp, or getting tired of doing any one thing, you know, no progression in heaven. Or maybe some people think you will have all your wishes satisfied, but at what level are those wishes really occurring? Sometimes in the material heavens conceived by the adherents of various religions, you wouldn't want to go there. Fortunately, you know, I think it was Omar Khayyam, I think, something to this effect, I myself am my own heaven and hell. Plato represented the planets as moved by an intrinsic rector, one with his dwelling, like a boatman in his boat. Well, okay. The planet, as we can apprehend it, is a vehicle. Of course, the vehicle is complex and not just an outer vehicle. And the true boatman is the monad, ultimately, or the monad in extension. I think I'm going to do that one. Would you mind? M-I-E-X, M-I-E-X, No, that's Mex. That's not it. M-I-E-X. And not capitalized, M-I-E-X. Something doesn't want me to do that. M-I-E-X. And then I'll be able to use it in a nice way in other places. And I'll call it this, the monad in extension. Who is that monad in extension? It's all of us. So the monad in extension is the jiva, is even the soul in incarnation, is any form of consciousness. In a way, one would have to say, any form of consciousness is the monad in extension. The one universal monad in extension. And in great self-veiled ignorance as well. Going on. The planets... Right. The planets were not inanimate masses. You know, just... wrong one. Sorry. I always like my little red bracket there, you know. And I advise anybody who edits this in the future to please take out my superficial comments like that last one. The planets were not inanimate masses, but acting and living bodies. So not just material. Material aggregations. But acting, living bodies. And every aggregated material life, every material life is still an aggregation. But also, of course, the great entity using such living aggregations, as their vehicles. The planets were rational intelligences circulating around the sun. And this is our philosophy. Philly. This is our philosophy. This is our Pythagorean philosophy, but it goes on, of course, came from Atlantean and Lemurian sources, and finally came from Shambhala, which came from where? From the sun, which finally came from where? And on and on and on. The wisdom really is ageless, but I begin to think that the only place where the completeness of the ageless wisdom exists is within the absoluteness. Because, you know, when you add a bunch of ultimate negligibilities together, you don't get very much. So even the complete wisdom of the cosmos would be an ultimate negligibility. We'd have to go to the infinity of infinities to find the ultimate wisdom. Well, don't get me off on that. I know it's not your fault. I'm always ready to tangentialize, you know, because I have this passion for wholeness and to understand with completeness. Impossible, of course, but, you know, the passion still exists. And one day, well, I can't ever say that it'll ever happen. One can understand universality without understanding completeness, because for me, universality can never be complete. There is this great negation of all ultimate negligibilities. We call this the absoluteness, and there only is the non-caused cause, which is infinitely complete forever. At least that's the great assumption and faith, and led to by rational thought, even though to many it seems irrational. The seven planets have for supreme spirits fortune and destiny, who uphold the eternal stability of the laws of nature throughout incessant transformation and perpetual agitation. Well, I wonder if this is Jupiter, in a sense, or the higher correspondence to it, or Saturn. But, you know, maybe we should not be quite so concrete as we look at that possibility. The seven planets have for supreme spirits fortune and destiny, who uphold the eternal stability of the laws of nature. You know, in other words, fortune, well, maybe it's the other way around, you know, or the other way around, because fortune is sometimes a fate, or fortune is fate, which is Saturn in that sense. And destiny is the full possibility, and destiny belongs to the monad, which is Jupiterian in our system. So maybe. But both of them, you know, there are the possibilities that lie ahead and also the obstacles to those possibilities. So there is perpetual motion and even friction and agitation before harmony is achieved. And it looks like we human beings are not the only ones who are going to have our parts and pieces at war with each other. It seems that whatever being is conceived, as it works its way up from the lower consciousness within its own ring past knot to the higher consciousness of its ring past knot and beyond, there's going to be agitation, friction. There's always going to be a fire by friction phase, wouldn't you say? Always a fire by friction phase. And then a solar fire, which is more phase, which is more harmonizing, and then a electric fire, which is homogenizing. Solar fire is harmonizing, and electric fire is homogenizing, making one thing out of many. The ether is the instrument or medium by which all is produced. But what is the ether? Is it simply systemic ether? Is this simply the systemic ether? Or is it cosmic ethers and super cosmic ethers and so forth? In other words, always the higher four subplanes in any seven-plane system. So you've got a systemic physical plane, the higher four subplanes of the ethers. You've got a systemic cosmic plane, the higher four subplanes, which we call our systemic planes, are the ethers. You've got a higher super cosmic plane, it's an etheric physical plane, and the higher four of those cosmic planes, which are really subplanes of a supercosmic plane, are the ethers. And you know what I mean by that. That's it. These higher four are the ethers. And on it goes, on it goes. So what really are the ethers? Well, maybe we have to be self-contained in any particular system. We're talking about kinds of agitations within the lower worlds, I suppose. And then it's enough for us to deal with our systemic ether. Are there agitations? Every time I do that. Are there internal agitations as well as agitations within the more material substances? Well, maybe. It's not easy to harmonize the vehicles and principles of any being, and even the subtle vehicles can be out of harmony. I think that is true. The seven gods were divided into two triads and the sun. Okay, well, we're dealing with the historical approach to astrology, and fortunately, Master DK has taken all that, given it to us in many ways, and also expanded greatly upon it. So, two triads, with the sun, as it were, in the middle, and notice we're not going to go, we're not including Vulcan, and we're not going beyond Saturn. But the moon is standing for a hidden planet, but is that hidden planet a fourth-rate planet of its own nature? And then what about the planet veiled by the sun? So Mars, Mercury, and Venus, well, we know there is a relationship between those. So Mars, Mercury, and Venus, we have in a way the mental body, Mercury, the emotional body, Venus, the physical body, Mars. But here's the higher triad. It's Jupiter, Saturn, and what? Well, what's veiled by the moon? And standing for a hidden planet. Was it hidden at the time, or is it hidden now? So, let's say, if it was hidden at the time of the ancients, it could be Uranus, Neptune, and Vulcan. All those were hidden. But if it is hidden at the time of HBB's writing, then it is probably Vulcan. Well, Vulcan would be the first-rate planet, Jupiter the second, and Saturn the third. We could have very well Vulcan's association with spiritual will and Atma, even though Saturn is connected with it. Jupiter's connection with Buddhi, and Saturn definitely with the third-ray higher mind. This is possible. If Uranus was the hidden planet, it's always hard to say whether, you know, Uranus does represent the brilliant abstract mentality in one way, and Saturn does represent Atma. So we're not sure which this should be, but anyway, we do get the idea that we're dealing with all Saturn and the intra-Saturnian planets, and the Sun in a category by itself, and there are no more, if we're dealing with intra-Saturnian planets, dealing only with intra-Saturnian, then it has to be Vulcan. And Vulcan fits well, you know, with its first-ray soul, Jupiter, second-ray soul, and Saturn, most probably third-ray soul. The question is, can it have a third-ray soul and a third-ray monad? And in a way, why not? If our Sun in the next solar system, in order to generate a first-ray solar system of will, should have a first-ray personality because it can't change its soul ray from 2 to 1. And if our Sun is right now a fourth-ray monad, or emphasizing the fourth sub-ray of the monad, it's likely a second-ray monad as well. So probably even our solar logos has a 2-2 when we consider it soul and monad, ultimate monad, not a final monad. I mean, one of my researches here, or my thoughts, is really that the monadic ray is dual. The triadal ray is dual. The soul ray is dual. About the personality ray, well, look at the sun sign and its ray, maybe for a dual ray of the personality, and every other vehicle is dual. There is a mental ray and a mental subray, an astral sub, and the etheric and etheric sub. It's really etheric ray is the physical ray. Some people differentiate, but I don't think that's correct. But, you know, lest we get lost in the trees and don't see the forest, it's a little dangerous to throw around too many distinctions, because the distinctions can become so plentiful that we become lost in the complexity and cannot see them, the whole. Of course, I'm very guilty of that, but when I get into these fine distinctions, you know, I would hope or suggest you take the Terra test that Rick Good and I have created, and it will be an opportunity to explore intuitively, I suppose, rationally, but hopefully intuitively, these higher distinctions in your nature. Of course, sometimes we have to reach out to a place where we are, do not yet stand. Okay. But then we do that, and then one day we will stand. It's like the, I know very little about mountain climbing, be a terrible mountain climber, but except I always wanted to when I was a kid. But, you know, when you throw the, is it called a piton? It has hooks in it that can grab onto rocks in a steady manner. You pull yourself up. You know, speculation is the throwing of the piton. And maybe you'll find a place to anchor. You know, if it's no place to anchor, it's all probably a bad idea. If there is a place to anchor, there's probably some kind of connection between the speculation and a higher reality. Then you pull on that rope and pull yourself up to the point where you can realize intuitively the thing about which you simply speculated at first. Okay. Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus are the four exoteric planets and three others which must remain nameless. Well, this is a secret doctrine, you know. So, Neptune had been discovered. Right. They are exoteric. Okay, well, of course, Saturn, Venus, Mercury, Jupiter are all, as well, planets of a sacred nature. But, and three others are also considered exoteric. It looks like we cannot count Uranus and Pluto among these, Uranus and, we cannot count Uranus and Neptune among these exoteric planets. They were known at the time of this writing, Uranus and Neptune. Pluto was not known. And so AAB inserts that. Vulcan is not known. And in a way, Saturn should be considered a great synthesizer. Let's read the whole thing and see if then we can speculate. And three others which must remain nameless were the heavenly bodies in direct astral and psychic communication, morally and physically, with the earth, its guides and watchers. And two hidden planets. You kind of wonder why Mars is not considered to be an exoteric planet. It's very exoteric. Unless he just doesn't want to list them. Pluto and Mars are certainly possible, and Vulcan also. And there is a Pluto-Mars-Vulcan connection. I think we're not talking here, not talking about the non-sacred planets veiled by the sun and moon. I think that's just too far a stretch. But Pluto had not been discovered. Vulcan had not been discovered. Maybe we're really dealing again with intra. No, we can't be dealing with intra-Saturnian planets if Pluto is to be in mention. Well, there is a definite connection with Earth. Now, you kind of wonder whether Earth is not the other planet. Pluto and the two hidden planets. Well, what are the hidden planets? Vulcan is definitely one hidden planet. Is there another specifically hidden planet at this time? Or maybe this cannot be resolved. Were the heavenly bodies in direct astral and psychic communication, morally and physically, with the Earth? So it can't be the Earth. No, I would suspect that what we've got here is the triangle of Vulcan, Mars, and Pluto. And certainly there is much of astrality. Both Mars and Pluto have a strong astrality. We understand that Pluto has a direct connection with the solar plexus center. Mars rules the solar plexus center, but also the sacral center. And Vulcan is a hidden planet. So they were the heavenly bodies in direct astral and psychic communication, morally and physically, with the Earth, its guides and watchers. So we have somehow eliminated the two higher of the synthesizing planets. And maybe We can do that. Here's how they look, and they are, in a way, separated off from these seven, in which Pluto is not mentioned, but Vulcan is. And really, there are only, there are seven here, one surrounded by the six. And let's see if we've, he just has not mentioned Mars, but Mars is such an important planet, so exoteric, and so involved with the astral, psychic condition of the Earth, and very physically related to the logos of our Earth. There's such a close connection between Venus, Earth, and Mars, Venus pulling in one direction, Mars in a way pulling in another. The visible orbs furnish our humanity with its outward and inward characteristics, and their regents with our monads and spiritual faculties. So this is another way of saying that our monads come from the logoi of the visible planets. Now, basically, does this mean that they do not come from Pluto or from Vulcan? I would say no in the case of Vulcan, because I can see every reason for Vulcanian lotuses and Vulcanian monads to be here on Earth, and even the names of the graduates of these two planetary schools are so similar: fiery stones for Vulcan and living stones for the Earth. Each one of us is attempting to become a living stone. So the visible orbs, they would include Uranus and they would include Uranus and Neptune, both of which were visible at the time of this writing. But Pluto was to become visible. So maybe this is saying that our monads do not come from the etheric, or astral planets, and only from the visible planets. Well, Vulcan too, one day will be visible, by some means at least, and we already have that strong sense that there is a humanity on Vulcan, which is has developed twice as far as the humanity on Earth. Two-fifths of its humanity have achieved. What have they achieved? Some status, and about five-fifths, I mean almost the whole thing on Venus, and only one-fifth on the Earth. Well, just to digress for a moment, two-fifths Vulcan. Again, it must be noted that Earth, Mars are as yet developing matter. Here it goes. As yet, it must be noted that Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and Vulcan are as yet developing manas, and the stage reached in each varies and is not for exoteric publication. Oh, okay. Well, the heavenly men of those schemes have not yet succeeded in bringing their bodies to the stage where transmutation on a large scale is possible. At least we're dealing with transmutation, which could be considered a kind of success. Maybe even the need no longer to return. They are approaching it, and where the necessary three-fifths is reached, then they will begin to transmute on a larger scale. The Earth scheme has about one-fifth in process of transmutation in one or another of the globes. At this time, Vulcan has very nearly two-fifths, and somehow I'm recalling that Venus really has transmuted her humanity. So Vulcan has gone twice as far, and if you have if you, I think you have here human beings, or those who are in the fourth kingdom, and Vulcan as well. And the units are the monadic units, and they have to be transmuted, probably to be on one or other stage of the path. Oh, this is such a marvelous book, and if you think that the astrology book has to be read with meticulous entirety, good Lord, just think about what you have to do with Cosmic Fire. To translate it is one thing. We're grateful to the many translators who have put it in other languages and so forth, but to understand it, it evades everything but initiate understanding. And what level of initiate, I'm sure there are things there that initiates of the third degree will not understand, and it's probably stratified in that way. So anyway, our monads come from the visible orbs. But what is visible? Well, that depends on the period about which we're talking. Do we have here a connection which is in astral and psychic communication, morally and physically, with the Earth? Have we, and are we justified in leaving Uranus and Neptune out of the picture as the two highest of the synthesizing planets, and somehow including Vulcan? Although D.K., Alice Bailey is talking about the two hidden planets. The only planets, well, there are three planets that she could call hidden planets. Vulcan is one. But the sun veiling a non-sacred second-ray planet, and the moon veiling a non-sacred fourth-ray planet, could also be considered hidden planets. So then, in that case, there would not be justification for saying the two hidden planets, because there would be three. And of course, at the time of this writing, Pluto would have been considered, well, at least an undiscovered planet. So maybe four were undiscovered. So putting together the astronomical views of this earlier time and our present understanding of astronomy, we run into some questions. Simply because they remain nameless does not mean they're hidden or undiscovered. And I have to put that in. Just because these planets remain nameless does not mean they are necessarily hidden or undiscovered. Because there were certainly enough planets which have to remain nameless. But, what makes a planet exoteric? Is it, it can't be just that it's a non-sacred planet, because Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, and Venus are sacred planets and still exoteric. So when we're searching among these exoteric planets, for exoteric planets, do we necessarily have to search only among the non-sacreds? Well, there's only, how many non-sacreds are left? Well, Mars is not mentioned. Pluto wasn't discovered as a non-sacred. Mars is non-sacred. And the two really hidden planets are veiled by the Sun and Moon, respectively. But if we include such sacred planets as Mercury and Venus, Venus being far ahead of most, and certainly of Vulcan, why not include Vulcan? It's hidden, it's sacred, but it's not more sacred than Venus, which is considered to be an exoteric planet. So we have to match the astrological perspective of Blavatsky with that which is laid out perhaps in a somewhat clearer manner and less blinded manner, I would say, than Master D.K., though he certainly does preserve his blinds. The Trinity was represented by the Sun, the Father, Mercury, the Sun, there it's masculine, and Venus, the Holy Spirit. This is very interesting. So in this case, Mercury is masculine, and the Sun is masculine. The Sun, though masculine, is associated with the second aspect of divinity. Well, but Venus is often monastic. Venus is often monastic and is certainly a, as they call, comforter, bringing harmony in the sense of well-being and beauty and so forth. A strange association with the Holy Spirit in a way one would expect. In one way, Uranus the Father, Neptune the Sun, among the synthesizing planets, and Saturn the third ray, Holy Spirit. But the connection of Venus, not with the third ray, but at least with Manus and with the mental permanent atom, not the mental unit, but with the mental permanent atom, is pretty strong. So I don't know in what day and era this used to be, but there is a representation here. Yes. Okay, I'm just trying to see how far progressed we may be. Pretty far progressed. All right then, so a little bit of an unlikely representation because, you know, you normally think in a way, although the Mercury is connected with the Sun of Mind, and it's also, it's connected with soul consciousness in a certain sense, an aspect of mind that belongs to the soul, but it also has all of this a third ray connected with it, and Venus does not. The connection of Mercury with the third ray is much more solid than Venus, although Venus, as I say, does often represent the mental, the monastic permanent atom. So we'll just, we don't know what period this comes from. It was represented, so this is a historical factor, and the Sun is the Father, and Mercury is the Sun, S-O-N, and Venus, the magnetic Holy Spirit. Okay, I wouldn't know how to go into that any more than I already have. There were seven tabernacles ready to be inhabited by monads, under seven different karmic conditions. And I suppose these are outer vestures. There were seven different types of human beings in the early days. Now, was the monad connected with the first two root races? Probably in a kind of supervisory condition, but there was no individualization of the monads. So we'd have to look at the context for that. I don't think we're talking here of the seven principles. I doubt that. But seven distinct types of vehicles under seven different karmic conditions. Another way of looking at this, not sure about the context in which HPB is talking about it, is the seven types of causal bodies, which were created at individualization, and which were the vessels of the seven types of monads. And indeed, there are seven types of monads. You just have to look at the seven monadic groupings that are found in Letters on Occult Meditation, and you definitely get that idea. Here, let's see, 35X. There are, on the monadic plane, seven great groups. Now, if there were not seven types of monads, which are really, I think, sub-ray types of a greater and higher threefold typology, you wouldn't have seven great groups on the monadic plane. So that's page 39 of Letters on Occult Meditation. All right. And they are under seven different karmic conditions, but it's interesting how Blavatsky talked in The Secret Doctrine of the men of different colors, and there were blue men, and there were red men, and maybe there were yellow men. And you begin to think that those colors are a little bit closer to the colors we begin to think about. I mean, in other words, when we talk about yellow men today, we sometimes mean the Oriental races, but of course it's not really yellow at all. It just is verging towards, it has that type of pigment. And when you maybe talk about some of the black members of the black race, some are so very dark that there's almost a bluish tint. But he's not talking about that as well. And when he talks about the red men, well, the Native Americans are not red necessarily, not at all. But maybe in those ancient days, when we were talking about the early forms of the tabernacles, we may have had colors that were closer to the colors as we recognize them now. I cannot say for sure. Maybe, you know, it would take a psychic like Leadbeater or someone very reliable to be able to see that for certain. We wonder whether HPB actually could do that. Maybe she could. I mean, she was considered a woman of rare ability. Maybe she could. Anyway, seven different types of monads, seven tabernacles, whether we're talking about the causal tabernacle or go back even earlier before the creation of the causal tabernacle, looking at the outer sheath and its different colors. One could, you know, look up even the word blue in the secret doctrine and find that. Every race has its evolution, and in its evolution is said to be born under the influence of one of the planets. Well, you know, what can we say? Mercury is a good planet for the Aryan race in consciousness. Aryan race. Okay. It makes me wonder. A-R-Y. A-R, just A-R. That's how simple it is for the Aryan race. Mercury is a good planet because it is essentially a fifth-ray monad, I think, with a third-ray monad, and we're developing the great fifth ray. And is it in the monadic nature that this is happening? I don't know. Venus would be useful for the sixth root race. And we can imagine that a greater deal of a greater Buddhic harmony will come. Of course, from the fifth-ray perspective, we could say Venus is good for the Aryan race, and because of its Buddhic connection, we could say that Mercury is good for the sixth-root race, because, you know, it's a star of intuition, from a sense, in a sense. I have the feeling that under Saturn, the third root race was born. And maybe, you know, she may describe this further, but some of the greater planets may be involved in the pre-individualized races, like Jupiter or Uranus and so forth. Neptune would be another good planet for the sixth root race, with its strong sixth ray, Neptune, possibly, in relation to the sixth root race. When it comes to the seventh root race, it's pretty obvious that Uranus, being the seventh ray planet, would, unless another seventh ray planet is discovered meanwhile, would be a good finale here. But Jupiter also has much of the seventh ray. So for the seventh root race, SVN, all right, so let's see what this can be. SV, seventh what? Can it be possible that I have no seventh root race here? SVRR, we'll call it the seventh root race. Or let's just leave it out of caps. Seventh root race. That'd be a good way to do it. Seventh root race. SVRR. So for the seventh root race, Uranus distributing ray 7 would be a good candidate. And maybe, you know, maybe even Venus can rule the Lemurian stage, because we are becoming individualized, but before that we were not individualized. In a certain way, Saturn is the entry into real concretion. The first two root races, which were not especially intelligent, they didn't have the mind, they didn't have individualization, they were densifying all the time, moving towards Saturn. So you begin to wonder whether some sort of Jupiterian or Neptunian possibility existed there. And, of course, the sub-races also would be present. They would have to come under planets that were appropriate to them, with second sub-race possibilities under Jupiter, perhaps, and third sub-race possibilities under Saturn, maybe fourth under Mercury from that point of view. And fifth, what? Under Venus? Sixth under Neptune? Is that possible? If we just deal with the soul rays? And seventh under Uranus? Another way of looking at this then. So, of looking at this is to simply take the soul rays of the planets and assign the planets sequentially to the root races accordingly. But we would get some anomalies here. I think the general principle is important. Both Mercury and Venus are very important in the fifth root race. Venus and Neptune will be very important in the sixth. Mercury will also be important in its more intuitive guise. I wonder if she talks about, if she actually offers what planets the root races are under. Seems to me that there was so much physical limitation in the Lemurian root race. Now what about the Atlantean root race? Well, Atlantean root race. I could have Mars for the astral body, Neptune for the water. I think so. Not Mercury, no. And not Venus, I think not. Mars and Neptune are more likely, even though Mercury distributes the fourth ray and there was plenty of conflict. But it was an astral race, and that's why it was an astral race. It was an astral root race. Okay. Okay. So, again, we're not going to come up with exactly what she meant unless it's in the book somewhere and someone can do the research on this, but we're reasoning about how to do this. Saturn, Mars, Saturn, third root race, third ray, but Venus for individualization. Atlantis, Mercury, no, even though it's a fourth ray planet. Mars, sixth ray, Neptune, sixth ray, astral polarization, I think so. Physical polarization in the first root race is very Saturnian. I think we all have to agree about that. Mental polarization in the, or mental focus at least, in the fifth root race is very Mercurian. Mercury is a far more mental planet, ultimately, than Venus. The polarization in Buddhi, in intuition, well, that is Mercurian in one sense, it's Neptunian in another sense. What is the most likely possibility of Lemurian, Saturn, physical plane polarization, Atlantean, and also, you know, the planet Earth, of course, would be important in Lemuria, and is still very important among those who are the remnants of the Lemurian root races who are among us now. Atlantean, Mars, war, let's say, astral plane polarization. We'll have also the Aryan race. I think under Mercury, mental polarization. But also maybe later Buddhic, some Venus for the solar angel contact. Sixth root race, Neptune, and Venus for the love energy. And this is intuitive. And then we have the seventh root race, which will involve Uranus, but Vulcan can also be involved, polarization in spiritual will. So there may be some shared space here, and we really, you know, shouldn't eliminate Saturn as well. Saturn does rule Atma from a certain perspective. If we go earlier, well, you know, I want to include Jupiter as well here because of its intuitive nature. Jupiter, second ray, and intuitive. So Uranus and Vulcan, yes, and you know there's a funny relation here of Lemuria to the, I would say, moon veiling Vulcan. It's very concrete, very physical. But DK's, or let's see, HBB seems to have in mind that the root race is said to be born under the influence of one of the planets. So, you know, even if we look at Lemuria, if without Venus, it would not have been born. There would have been no individualization, no coming of the solar angels, no implanting of the spark of mind, and so forth. So, but that's only the latter half of the Lemurian root race. What was the other half? And, you know, the division of the sexes is more a cleaving Saturnian thing, the divine separator. So Venus does have a role to play. Venus has a role in the second part of the third root race. And, you know, it's hard to exclude Neptune from the Atlantean root race. Neptune related. After all, it did succumb to the great waters, which is not Martian, it is Neptunian. And Lemuria succumbed to volcanoes, which is Vulcanian. The Aryan race, yes, Mercury, the thinker, the rational thinker, but some of the higher mind coming in under Venus. The sixth root race, not Martian in the sixth ray sense, Neptunian, and the love energy of Venus. But don't forget the fulfillment in love of Jupiter, possible. Well, you know, people with a strong, I think, third ray, the way I have it, they have trouble settling on only one option. Problematic. She says one, and I'm coming up with other alternatives. You know, there's a joke that if you ask a first ray type a question, you get an answer. If you ask a third ray type a question, you get an option. Could be this, could be that. Well, I have to offer you lots of options as we try to gather a holistic vision in meticulous entirety of our planet, system, local cosmos, etc. There are many possibilities. If I could give you, you know, some kind of initiate understanding from the higher perspective, one day to be possible, you know, what an initiate of the high degrees would know. Sometimes Sinnet, was it A.P. Sinnott? Well, anyway, his name was Sinnott. He was asking Master K.H. questions pertaining to the fifth or sixth initiation. Well, if I could give those kinds of perspectives, obviously I couldn't, because it wouldn't be allowed. So meanwhile, speculation is required. So here we are then, friends. We have, this is the end, of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 151B, page something. I'm getting a little discouraged when I look at the pages because they're not going by very fast. We're spending plenty of time on these things. Maybe I'm going to have to find the page. Is it 645? Let's see if we can look here. It looks like page 640. 644, I guess. Now that'll have to do. Wherever 644 is. Is there any place that says 644? Let's see. 644. Aha. Well, we're almost there. So it's still 643. It was right in front of my nose. Page 643. And beginning with Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 152, I think it's best to do that. A, page 643. All right. Well, for me, very, very interesting things, pointing out to me what I don't know and what so many may not know either, but offering perspectives of the ancients when this comes from the secret doctrine and how it was in these perspectives that the more modern and complete presentation of esoteric astrology was somehow hinted or contained. We have to break through HPB's blinds here in order to see how the astrology the DK is presenting us with actually was implied in what she said. So that's what we want to do. All right. Well, we'll go on before long, and let's keep studying this great subject. Okay, see you soon. Bye-bye.